Good evening. My name is Bruce Lindsay, and I have been invited by the Utah Debate Commission to moderate the first exchange in their schedule of debates for the 2016 election season. We are live at the Eccles Fine Arts Center on the campus of Dixie State University in St. George for a long scheduled debate for candidates for Utah Attorney General. And within the past 24 hours, everything has changed. If you have been following news reports today, you will have heard that the Democratic candidate for Attorney General, John Harper, late last night withdrew his candidacy. Mr. Harper cited unspecified medical reasons, so he is not here, and we have an empty podium. But the Utah Debate Commission's policy and decision is to continue with the debate, even if there is only one candidate. That policy is designed to set a precedent to prevent giving one candidate veto power over a debate. If a candidate knows that he or she can stop a debate by refusing to participate, then the debate can be manipulated. The policy is intended to remind candidates who withdraw that the UDC debate will continue with or without them. Now, no third-party candidates in the race qualified to participate based upon the Commission's established polling numbers. Additionally, the fine people here at Dixie State have made great preparations for this event. The Debate Commission would not let them down, nor would it let you down as an engaged voter. The incumbent Republican candidate, Sean Reyes, has agreed to proceed, and I am confident you will find this hour to be informative. Mr. Reyes, welcome.
Thank you very much, and good evening, Bruce.
Good evening. The format called for you to make an introductory statement of about 2 minutes, and I see no reason we need to change that. Would you please introduce yourself to the audience?
Very good. Well, first of all, let me thank the Utah Debate Commission, Dixie State University, and all of you tuning in this evening. And before I begin, I would also like to send a word of concern and my best wishes to John Harper and his family for a speedy recovery. When I first took office, almost 3 years ago, I promised to restore trust. My team and I set about immediately implementing protocols, enhancing policies to protect integrity. Well, how have we been doing? Just last year, a national foundation and the University of Utah recognized me and my office with a prestigious national award for ethics in government. The award acknowledged the highest level of ethics in integrity, accountability, fairness, and transparency. Another promise I made was to protect our families from white-collar and violent criminals, from government overregulation, from internet predators. And in the first year alone, we led historic wins against human traffickers, drug traffickers, and fake ID rings. Recently, I was referred to by a noted FBI expert as the top attorney general fighting cyber crimes and white-collar crimes. I also promised to restore a culture of legal excellence, and we have won back-to-back Best of State awards, including the Best State Agency. We also were just recognized by all other AG offices in the nation for the Best Supreme Court Brief. Finally, I promised to be a true lawyer for the people. And we fought for the little guy, from rural interests to refugees, veterans, victims, homeless, and the disabled community. We've taken on giants like Big Pharma, the federal government, and VW, in which case I just brought back millions of dollars to the consumers of the great state of Utah. In short, I keep my promises. That's why you don't need to go looking for integrity. It's already here. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Reyes. He won the coin toss, by the way, to speak first tonight. Mr. Reyes, abuse of illegal and prescription drugs is recognized as a problem in Utah, and some people view drug use crimes as relatively minor offenses that fill up our jails and our prisons with people who really aren't dangerous. What policies will you follow toward drug crimes, and how will you prioritize enforcement and prosecution of drug offenses?
You know, there is a balance, Bruce, in whenever you're trying to balance, send a message about illegal and illicit drugs, but also there is a human side to the equation. And I think for many years, the criminal justice system has not acknowledged that enough. And I would be very supportive. We have championed criminal justice reform, diversionary programs like drug courts, rehabilitative programs that allow ex-felons to get training, education, and reintegrate and become productive members of society. We have lowered some of the penalties for certain types of drugs. And again, I think there's a balance there. You don't want to send a message that we're not tough on crime, But with drugs, I think it's especially opioid addictions, which are rampant and become an epidemic, not just in our state, but around the nation. I think it's hit so close to home that everybody realizes these are not hardened street criminals we're talking about. These are our kids. These are soccer moms. These are the people that we meet, our neighbors, every day and we go to church with. And we really need to do something. We can't incarcerate our way out of this issue. There's not room in the prisons. It's not fair. And why put somebody in an environment that will only exacerbate the problem, that will deny them the opportunity to get the help and the healing that they need, again, for a chance to become reintegrated? I love Les Miserables. I love the protagonist Jean Valjean and the story and arc of redemption. And I think there is a fine balance. We, again, very supportive of law enforcement. We are an investigative and prosecutorial office. But we also have to understand the human side of the equation. And by allowing diversionary programs that will still allow for punishment, that will still hold perpetrators accountable, but yet give them opportunities to make amends and become productive, those are the types of programs that we have championed. There's one called the 24/7 program, for instance, for DUIs. Again, that will allow people, instead of losing jobs and cars and not getting rehabilitation, to be able to work, check in, have drug tests, and still maintain their employment. So those are the types of things that I'd love to continue to champion.
Do you have the initiatives in place that you enumerate here, or
yes.
That's a wish list?
No, sir. We have passed last year legislation already. We're working with Ogden and Weber County with a pilot program for that 24/7 program. Drug courts have been in place for a number of years. They're underfunded, and we need to make sure that the legislature and their wisdom provides enough for us to be able to. You can't have the carrot and then not fund it in the end. These are some of the things that law enforcement is grappling with right now. But there, fortunately, I believe, is a confluence of interests on the progressive side, on the conservative side, because these are really humanitarian issues that we're talking about right now. We can't afford it, so economically it doesn't make sense. And we can't afford it, more importantly, from, again, a humanitarian standpoint. So we have these programs in places, they need to get funded. They need to have continued support from law enforcement and from the business community and from our government.
Thank you. Questions and topics that we'll cover tonight were submitted by voters to the Utah Debate Commission website. Others are joining me in questioning Mr. Reyes this evening. They include a group of very engaged students here at Dixie State University, whom I'll introduce as they appear, and Hal Boyd, the opinion editor of the Deseret News. Let me introduce Hal and call on you, please, Hal, for a question.
Thank you. Mr. Reyes, there's been much discussion about an anticipated lawsuit against the federal government regarding ownership of public lands. Do you anticipate to file this lawsuit, or is it just a waste of public funds?
Let me preface the answer, as any good lawyer might do, with a little bit of context and say that I don't think the issue of ownership of public lands is a zero-sum game. It's not about one interest to the exclusion of all others. I think we should be striving for a balance of interests that can coexist. These include conservation and protection of our beautiful natural areas, preservation of wildlife habitats and sacred sites, recreation for hunting, fishing, hiking, climbing, camping, ATV access, and of course also exploration and extraction of natural resources, which would allow for taxation and funding for education through many generations. I think all of these interests are important. I think there is a way to balance them. And instead of demonizing one side or the other, I think it makes much more sense to try to come together in education, try to negotiate, for instance, legislation that Senator Mike Lee and Congressman Rob Bishop had put forward, the PLI, Public Lands Initiative, is one that we're watching closely, one that we can learn from. I believe that there should be a sharing of management between the federal government, the state, counties, which have so much of a vested interest and feel the brunt and impact probably most, and their citizens, and tribes as well. They have an important place at the table. Unfortunately, And historically, the federal government has so predominated the decision-making in that space that it's caused all sorts of problems. Federal land management is non-existent in some areas, and the federal government will admit that they don't have the resources or they don't have the political will to be able to effectively manage land. So, to your question, finally, are we filing a lawsuit? We are contemplating it. We've looked closely. We've examined all sorts of different legal arguments, including ones from experts that the Utah legislature hired, including a report that the Conference of Western Attorneys General just put together. I don't think litigation is the sole answer. I think it's part of an equation, again, that ultimately I believe it will be a political answer. I think litigation can clarify issues. I think litigation can narrow the scope of particular issues and bring people together to come up with a solution that will seek a balance of these interests. So as a good lawyer, we've taken our time. We well might file a lawsuit. I am very much about trying to find ways to get more power locally to the counties and the states. And frankly, most of the questions and concern are about a transfer of public lands. But what we do more in the AG's office is fight about other public land issues, things like the Endangered Species Act, whether it's gray wolf or whether it's prairie dogs, which are a popular creature down in these parts, or whether it's sage grouse. All of those have impacts on public lands, road access, stream bed access, and then related issues regarding water, waters of the United States, clean power, air, our SIP for Hays. We're litigating a lot of these things to be able to have more control at a local level and input into how these public lands are managed, who gets to make decisions about the benefits and access to these public lands. So it's a complicated, complex issue. It's unfortunately not one that I can give you a very quick bullet point answer. I don't think there's a lawsuit that I will be able to file that will cow the federal government into turning over all the lands to the state of Utah. And I'm not sure that that's what the state of Utah would want.
As a follow-up, you mentioned the Public Lands Initiative from Congressman Rob Bishop. And hearings have begun this week on the Public Lands Initiative in Washington, D.C. If that does not pass through Congress, it's widely anticipated that President Barack Obama will declare a national monument, effectively protecting Bears Ears and 1.8 million acres in that area. What do you anticipate doing in your office if that happens?
If the PLI doesn't pass, again, and we're talking about hypotheticals right now, if the president exercised a power under the Antiquities Act to designate a monument, we would be ready to file a lawsuit on behalf of the state of Utah to make sure that they being the federal government, have abided by all of the very strict rules in the Administrative Procedures Act. I don't think they have, and I think that there's a chance that we might be able to defeat that. And so we're looking right now as that as a contingency or a possibility. My preference is to see the PLI succeed, see all of these different interests that I mentioned at the table, again, tribal, federal, state, county, and come up with solutions short of an exercise that sweeping of the Antiquities Act. And let me also be clear that in our discussion, when we're talking about a potential transfer of power or land or even a divestment of the federal government, we're not talking about national parks or national monuments. So we're talking about a lot of land that many people wouldn't even have an interest in owning or controlling, but ranchers do and farmers do, and without proper management, it's killing them in terms of how they're being able to sustain their families and their way of life. So these are critical issues. I appreciate the question. I don't know if it feels like I've probably exceeded my time, but if you have another follow-up, I'm happy to continue going.
Hal, why don't we come back to you in just a minute and certainly invite the student panel to come forward. Thank you, Hal Boyd of the Deseret News. From Dixie State University here, Kimball Hafen has a question for the Attorney General.
Utah has been criticized for struggling to meet its constitutional duty to provide legal counsel to those who cannot afford it. What would you do to fix Utah's indigent defense system?
Sure. That is a critical issue. One of the things that we've done, we have a commission that I have one of my senior staff participating on to make sure, for instance, that defense counsel in rural counties aren't hired directly by county attorneys. For those of you who understand conflicts of law, you can see very quickly the potential for a conflict there. The defense counsel's salary is dependent on the prosecutor on the other side of the case, and in defense of some of the counties, they say we don't even have enough lawyers to be able to sustain that dynamic, and we don't have the expertise to go out and hire someone, so the county attorney has to do that. I still think it's too much of a conflict of interest, and so we have pushed to come up with different programs, and we've actually, I think, influenced several county attorneys to move away from that model. When I began my administration, there were some who were employing that, and now we've moved away, or they've moved away, I think in large part because of the influence that we've had on them. Indigent defense is critical. It's underfunded, I believe, and it's something that counties and the state will have to deal with. There's always a question about who ends up footing the bill for critical legal costs, and the cost of access to justice is also exorbitantly high, and that's something else that we have worked on through nonprofit organizations, groups like And Justice for All, trying to find alternative routes for people to access justice, for them to have representation. So it's I can't get into too much depth, because we actually have a case right now on that very issue that we're defending on behalf of the state of Utah, and hopefully I'm not disclosing anything that I shouldn't be. But thank you for the question.
Did you get an answer you're looking for, Kimball?
I did.
All right, thank you. Let's call on Hal Boyd again from the Deseret News.
I'm back for better or worse here. So, a common practice in attorney general's offices is to outsource legal work. And this has been reported that your office outsources some of the legal work that is done for the state. How can you assure the Utah voters that this is a efficient use of taxpayer money, on the one hand, and also that the work being done lives up to the standards that Utah voters would expect of your office?
So a couple of different points on that. There is some outsourcing that doesn't cost the state anything. When we join in multi-state litigation, for instance, with the state of Texas, with a lot bigger population, more assets, they will do the heavy lifting on a lot of the drafting, the briefing. We may have one person reviewing, like myself or a senior staff member. And so that type of outsourcing, which I don't think is what you're getting at exactly, I think is a very healthy preservation of resources. There are times when we have expertise, despite the fact that we have amazing, dedicated professionals who are experts in so many different areas in the Attorney General's office. There are times when we need subject matter experts in a particular area to be able to help us move forward with litigation. One example is Sage Grouse litigation, where the state of Utah ended up hiring experts in that area to litigate the fact that Utah already had a very good plan in place, and then the federal government, although it didn't list, essentially rejected a number of the state proposals, and now that's in litigation. On a side note, because one of the firms that was bidding for the work is my old private law firm, I recused myself, my chief criminal deputy recused himself, and we all walled ourselves off from having any input into that process. So a panel of experts inside the AG's office and some other consultants went out, bid that work out, and was able to negotiate a very fair deal for that outside help. So in certain limited circumstances, it's very beneficial to the state. That's hourly work. There are occasionally contingency fee cases where an outside firm will come and take most of the risk, pay millions and millions of dollars up front for expert costs and litigation costs. If the state of Utah were to take on a case like Big Pharma, like I mentioned before, we may not have the resources. Our lawyers are overworked, understaffed, already balancing so much, and to try to strap them with a gigantic case like that, sometimes it makes sense. To balance that, we helped support a bill two sessions ago, maybe three now, to be able to put some limits on how much you can pay to outside contingency counsel so that dollars stay within the state as much as possible. We still want to be able to have the discretion to go out and hire the best of the best if they're not already here with us in our office, but we put some guardrails about how much money they can make. It's a good vetting process. There is an opt-out in extraordinary cases. If I get the approval from the governor, the auditor, or the treasurer, or a combination of them, we could even opt out of some of those caps or limits on contingency fees. So I think it's a very healthy approach. Every state that I know, every other attorney general that I talk to, and I sit on a number of national committees and leadership positions, from time to time, go outside to enlist the help of experts, sometimes lawyers, sometimes just experts in key subject matter area.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Hal. Mr. Reyes, do you agree with the governor and with the legislature that pornography is a public health crisis? And if you do, what will you do to address that from a legal perspective?
You know, I'm not sure even what public health crisis means, Bruce, from a legal standpoint. But I will say, I think it is a great threat to our youth and even to adults. And let me tell you why. This is the perspective I come from, having worked with countless victims of pornography. These are victims of human trafficking, victims of child sexual abuse, victims of other types of violence and abuse. It's not to say that everyone who consumes pornography will end up being a child trafficker or child pornographer. But the vast majority of those that we prosecute have admitted to us that they're gateway to some of these horrendous crimes, some of these very dark places that they are, was through pornography. And there are groups like Fight the New Drug, which was a group that was started here in Utah that has an international following of fighters, hundreds of countries that spend millions of dollars with an online recovery program called Fortify that have helped and touched the lives of thousands out in the world, educating youth in a very entertaining but scientific way that when you become addicted to pornography, it is like becoming addicted to hard drugs. And the need and desire to get a fix becomes greater and greater. And what could be what some might call innocent a gateway pornography can lead to darker and darker perversions, things in the dark net, things that deal with little children. And so our office has to interact. We investigate, prosecute internet crimes against children, child pornographers. 2 years ago, we arrested a mother who was creating pornography with her 9-year-old special needs daughter and disseminating that, not just throughout Utah, but around the world. We're very aggressive about it. You asked what I would do from a legal standpoint. Not from a policy standpoint passing laws, but with the laws that we have in place, we will aggressively go after child pornographers. We will aggressively go after those who are illegally consuming and selling child pornography. We have worked with a number of tech companies to have the most cutting edge advantage in going after these pornographers, and our Internet Crimes Against Children's Task Force has been lauded numerous times for being one of the best units in the United States.
Okay, thank you. As we near the midpoint of our time tonight, I welcome you once again to this debate arranged for candidates for Utah Attorney General. Again, late last night, Democrat John Harper abruptly withdrew from the race. We are proceeding with questions for Republican Sean Reyes. You're joining us live on the campus of Dixie State University in St. George. And let's go back now to questions from our panel of students from Dixie State University. Sarah Romaker, please.
Thank you. Voter apathy among college-age students is surprisingly high. What do you say to those millennials who don't feel like their vote matters?
Every vote matters. I spend a lot of time going to events like Comic-Con and E3 entertainment software events, boxing, UFC matches, in part because I used to participate in those and I like those, but there are a lot of youth there and it gives me a chance to interact with them.
and hopefully reach out to them and let them know, regardless of political affiliation, you need to be civically engaged. I think there's so much to distract millennials these days. They have so much on their plates. There's so much stimulus or stimuli surrounding them. And they have, you all have, I should say, including you and that group, an incredible opportunity to impact the world in a way that no generation has ever before, through social media alone, and being able to raise awareness about critical issues like teen suicide or human trafficking or opioid addictions. All of these things, you can make a difference, and it makes a difference for who you support, who you elect. You know, learn about them, vet them, take the time. I get calls often from young people who want to sit down, and they're welcome to come to the Capitol. I meet with them there, I meet with them at, on campus, and we need that energy. There's a reason why there's, I think, why so many are jaded about politics, and politics sometimes doesn't seem very welcoming, especially to the younger generation. But I hope to be one who can bridge that and maybe make politics a little more accessible, relatable. I don't know if that says more about my diplomatic abilities, or like my wife said, I'm just a big kid. But I hope that you all will be inspired to go out and participate, join a campaign, do an internship, read up on literature, call up your local city councilman, attend meetings, be proactive, because I promise you, having sat through many, many sessions on the Hill, many hearings, just one voice can make the difference in saving thousands of lives, protecting families, getting resources to where they need to go. So I encourage you all, millennials and other young ones, to please, please participate.
So you're telling Sarah that every vote matters. Who are you voting for president, and tell us why?
Who am I voting for? I'm voting for Donald Trump for president because, I'll say this, he wasn't my first choice. I don't agree with Mr. Trump on everything. In fact, I've called him out publicly on a couple of issues. One was pretty public, actually at a LULAC event, when he made comments about Mexicans that I took issue with. He made a similar comment a few weeks ago about Filipino terrorists that offended me. And when I called and talked to his team, they clarified. And he said that he was inartful in how he communicated that. There is a terrorist presence in the Philippines, which as a Filipino I'm aware of and know about. And so although he's not careful and can come off in an off-putting way, to me, Bruce, the pivotal issue in the race is the Supreme Court and the judiciary of the United States. And we talk about SCOTUS, the Supreme Court, but we're also talking about a number of circuit court appointments. We're talking about hundreds of federal district court judge appointments. The next president, just with that power to appoint, nominate, I believe that alone will change the arc of our nation, the soul of our country, more than anything else that's at issue in this race. And we've had a balance, whether it swung one way or the other, for the last many years. Kind of 5-4 decisions, you go back and look how many decisions are 5-4 decisions. But the next president will likely appoint not just one or two, but possibly three justices. There's even a potential scenario for four, depending on how many terms that president serves. And so for me, Donald Trump has committed to appoint justices to the Supreme Court that I'm comfortable with, people who love the Constitution, who abide by the rule of law, who are careful jurists. And for that reason alone, I'm supporting Donald Trump.
All right, let's go back to Hal Boyd of the Deseret News.
Last week, the U.S. Commission on Civil Rights released a report in which it attempted to reconcile the at times competing values of non-discrimination on the one hand and religious liberty on the other. In their conclusions, they said that non-discrimination was, quote, preeminent over religious liberty, and that religious exemptions sometimes trample on the rights, civil rights, and non-discrimination. Where do you stand on this issue, and do you agree with the findings of the report?
I don't agree that either of those liberties are subordinate to the other. The problem and the question is, how do you come again to an equilibrium and balance those? And that is one of the great legal issues of our day. And that's also another reason, again, why the Supreme Court is of preeminent importance. Because I do believe right now, both by public opinion, through the media, and lower courts, it feels like religious liberties are taking a subservient position to civil liberties. And again, I am not saying that one is not important. I'm saying that we need to find a balance, but there are going to be issues time and time again now where the question becomes, how much do you protect lifestyles that may be in contradiction to what certain tenets of particular religions, and how much do you allow religious liberties to be accommodated in people trying to figure out how to coexist with each other. So I am somebody who supports a stronger emphasis on protecting religious liberties, but at the same time recognize that without fights about civil rights that have protected minorities, that have protected women, that have protected people of different gender orientation, that we wouldn't have some of the very good social outcomes that we have today. And so, it's a tough balance, but right now I feel like the religious liberty side is getting short shrift.
How do you define religious liberty?
It's, again, a term of art. Religious liberty is being able to exercise and live your religious conscience in a way that allows you to interact with somebody else and still keep your integrity, still stay true to your own values. It's an evolving legal definition, so that's why I'm having a little bit of a hard time giving you an exact definition. That's what the fight is all about right now. What is a religious liberty? How far does that liberty go? And we have other rights that have much longer jurisprudence, like Second Amendment. And you have cases like Heller that have embodied those. Right now, especially with a vacancy on the court, these questions are a little bit on hold, and we'll yet see as they come forward. And can I just make one? I think in my last response about Donald Trump, I may have given the impression that that was the only reason the Supreme Court. What I intended to say was that if that were the only reason, that would be worth it for me. Mr. Trump has expressed great support for other issues that are that I'm passionate about: fighting human trafficking, fighting white collar fraud, even criminal justice reform. I've talked to him. I've talked to his team. He's strong on the military and national defense. He's a big supporter of law enforcement, as am I. And so those things help, but the defining issue for me is the Supreme Court, to be clear.
Did you get your answer? Religious liberty, thanks. How? Let's return to our student panel with a question from Kendra Jensen from Dixie State University. Kendra.
Thank you. Under what circumstances would you not accept a campaign contribution because it might constitute an actual or potential conflict of interest?
Excellent question, because we run into this every time we take a contribution. We vet the contribution. If we feel like, even if it's a legal company, and ethically, there's nothing wrong with taking a contribution. There are certain companies or particular industries that I just don't want to associate myself or my brand with, and so that's one criteria. Another is if we are investigating, especially if we're prosecuting a company or an individual, I would not take a donation.
I mean, it seems like it's a shame to even have to articulate that as a standard, but given the history of the office and the allegations, I think I need to be on the record repeating that. If the company is doing business with the state of Utah, I've held off or returned donations. We have actually given money back or not taken donations. So again, this is an important issue. In some cases, it might be that another agency, not ours, another prosecutorial investigative agency, is looking into that company. I think we've taken extraordinary measures. In one particular case, we were the only ones of any of that I'm aware of, public officials or companies that took donations from a particular company. We put it in an escrow account to segregate it, saying, look, we're not going to use this, but it's a balance. If you return it back and they turn out to be indicted, then you've probably helped to facilitate defense costs. If you turn it back and they end up being exonerated, it looks like you've cast judgment over them by returning it. And so the healthy thing to do is leave it in an escrow account, wait till the other agency does their job and see. We do a lot of investigations that turn out in the end not to have merit. And as a side note, that is a powerful dynamic. We can ruin businesses. We can ruin people's reputations and lives. That's why we try to stay very careful, quiet about how we do those. We don't even acknowledge if we're investigating someone to the media, because we want to keep the presumption of innocence alive and due process.
Kendra will allow me to follow up on that. Sir? Given the history and the allegations, those are your words you used, about your office, once you vet a particular campaign contribution, under the laws of Utah, there is no limit to the size of that contribution. I think it's one of only four states that has no limits on campaign contributions. And some suggest that that dynamic played into the history and the allegations of your predecessors. Would Utah be better off with some campaign finance reform and a cap?
I would support reform of some sort. I don't know what the exact number is the right number or limitation, but I know the legislature has looked at that.
Back to her question, she said, is there anyone you would not take a contribution from? Is there any amount that you wouldn't take? Is there any upper limit?
No, I haven't thought of that really. So, I mean, if you wanted to try and offer me millions of dollars as a contribution, then we could test that hypothetical. But no, I'm being a little glib. I haven't thought about an upper limit. We're usually just happy if people are giving us $5 or $10 along our. Well, a lot of our donors are small donors that make contributions to get a yard sign. As long as it's a level playing field, and whatever rules apply across the board, I think that's what's fair. And then let people go out and make their case to the people.
Kendra, does that come to your question?
Yes, thank you.
Thank you. Thanks very much. Let's return to Hal Boyd from the Deseret News for another question, please.
Bruce mentioned briefly the allegations and accusations that have been made against the predecessors of your office, namely Attorney General Mark Schutliff and Attorney General John Swallow. What have you done and what can you do to assure the Utah voters that the same problems that occurred with your predecessors will not seep into your administration and are not taking place currently?
Well, to begin with, I'm not going to comment on either of their cases, and I didn't hear you asking me to do that, but there are a number of different protocols and processes and procedures that we put into place. I literally could spend an hour talking about. We've spent years refining these, and it took us right away months just to, one, we commissioned audits just to find out about all of what was going on. There was a lot of stuff I don't think anybody realized. We put those audits very transparently up on the website, whether it dealt with use of vehicles or how some previous cases were handled. I immediately divided the office team from the campaign team. That's why I've got two phones, I've got two laptops, I've got two staffs. It's a little difficult and duplicative, but it helps. I don't want the public ever to understand, or the public to ever believe, that we're using state funds to pay for my campaign, or even more importantly, that the people who are doing their job on the campaign, raising money, are the people who are making decisions, critical decisions, about who to prosecute or not prosecute in the office. In fact, I just had this occur not too long ago. One of the industry leaders for a particular industry called me up and had some important policy and legal issues to discuss. We talked about them. And then he said, "Sean, look, a lot of the people in our industry think that you're a very good leader, that you're trustworthy, you've brought integrity, restored trust and confidence back in the office. Is it possible for us to do something in terms of a fundraiser?" And I said, "Sure, but I want to call you back on my private phone." And he said, "Really?" He said, "It's been almost 3 years now. Everybody trusts you on the Hill. We know how careful you are. We know how careful your office is. You don't have to call me back on a different phone." And I said, "No, really, it's that important to me. Integrity is that important to me, transparency." And so I called him back on the other phone, gave him my campaign staff's number, and said, "You know what, why don't you call them and work that out? Appreciate it, thank you, but I don't want to commingle those things." You know, we've implemented a number of training policies, we've implemented a number of different protocols. I relieved every single leader in my office, from division directors down to section directors and all the senior staff, and made them all reapply on a level playing field, so that it didn't matter what, you know, political letter you had next to your name, or what church you went to, or who your father was and what your last name was. It was all about merit. And, you know, I even caught some heat from friends in the Republican Party who afterwards said, "You know that you've just elevated after these 3 months and promoting these leaders a bunch of Democrats into senior positions in your office?" And I said, I didn't know that because I never asked them. I wasn't aware. It's not how I compute. I don't calculate lost cases that we do by political points. I calculate them by what's under the law, and I really don't care if they're Democrats or Republicans or Klingons, for that matter, as long as they're doing work that's the highest caliber, they're committed to the people, that's who I need in place. And that's how we approach all of our lawsuits. You know, is politics a part of the office? Sure, it surrounds the office, but not partisan politics. You have to understand who your audiences are. You have to understand that every decision you make will have an impact on people's lives. And that's the part of the politics that I think I have to deal with. So again, I could tell you, I mean, I've got, just in terms of transparency, we reorganized an internal ethics committee. We had, for the first time ever, a public corruption unit that I organized to investigate. We were, the first time ever in the AG's office that we have a mechanism now for people, if they have somewhat like an internal affairs mechanism, if they have complaints even about the highest level of leadership in the AG's office, that there's a mechanism for outside agency to come in and investigate those. Because the AG's office can investigate those types of cases for other state agencies, but who's gonna investigate the AG's office? And so I think having those types of protocols in place, ethics training, making sure that our CLEs emphasize those types of issues, those are critical.
So I guess the only follow-up is, do you have Klingons working in your office?
Say, not that I've been able to confirm. We have two Romulans, I'm sure of it. But
we'll put a time limit on that response. Thanks, Hal. Mr. Reyes, in the last year, the state joined a lawsuit against the federal government over the Obama administration's advisory memo regarding the use of restrooms by transgender students. Please explain for us why that's an important issue for the Attorney General's office.
Sure, and let me be clear, Bruce, that case was never about bathrooms for us. It was about executive overreach and fourth branch of government that has come up, unelected, unaccountable agencies that try to dictate law bypassing Congress in an unconstitutional way. That's my view. And in this case, again, a little bit of context, what people don't realize is that for more than a decade, local school districts have been working with families of transgender kids with transgender students to make accommodations, sometimes even accommodating them for the bathroom of their choice. But what happened when the Department of Education issued its Dear Colleague letter is they put at risk and threatened to take away funding from all other or up to other programs for these same school districts that had good policies in place that families of transgender students appreciated. And all we asked the federal government was, is this truly a Dear Colleague letter where you're giving your recommendations of what good practice and policy should be? It doesn't sound like it because you're threatening. And if you're trying to make law using the purse strings, then we do have a problem with that. The federal government never responded to us. So in the absence of that, we filed a lawsuit to clarify what the issues are. Is this the Department of Education trying to change the definition of Title IX unconstitutionally without going through Congress or without themselves challenging some of these policies? If that's the case, then we do have an issue. If the federal government acknowledged, even in the case that we have right now, that it was just guidance and there wasn't a threat of taking away, much needed funding for other programs, even if a school was complying to the satisfaction of local families, but found in some way to not be in compliance with the Dear Colleague letter, if that was the case, if they said it's just guidance, I'd pull the state of Utah out of that lawsuit. But right now, they're taking the position that no, we're changing the definition of Title IX as an executive branch, as an agency that flies in the face of constitutional checks and balances. That's not supposed to be how it works, and I think we have good grounds to challenge that. We have one at the district court level. But in saying all of that, because it can sound very legal and clinical, I do want to emphasize that we care about transgender students. We met with transgender students, their families, in the process of going through this. We made this decision carefully. It's not something that we just woke up and said, you know what, let's just join. It's another chance to fight against the administration. We looked at and spoke with local districts, superintendents, and said, is this a problem? They said, no, this hadn't been a problem at all. In fact, in our discussions with several of the transgender students, they were upset at the Department of Education and the administration for what they said, essentially putting a target on their back. Life was fine for them. They had had accommodations to their satisfaction, whether they were private use bathrooms or whether they were bathrooms of their choice or bathrooms of their origin. And so, again, for me, the frustration and people who want to take a political issue with this will try to paint this as us not caring about transgender students. That is clearly not the case. We put a lot of time and resources in our office to protect students and kids of all backgrounds, regardless of whether they're legal or illegal in this country, whether they're what their sexual orientation is, what religion they are, what minority or religious or racial background they have.
Thank you. May I thank you there. We're not using the clock tonight, but we have a couple more students who are dying to ask you a question, so maybe we can be a little succinct on two of these so we can get to two more students at least. James Keener has a question for us, please.
Thanks, Bruce. I appreciate it. And before I ask you my question, I just want to let you know that I applaud your performance because I definitely think you're winning tonight, so keep it up.
Thank you. Thank you. I appreciate that.
My question for you, Mr. Reyes, is Utah's Children's Justice Centers, they investigate thousands of child abuse cases every year. And with that being said, I'm just wondering, what steps are you going to take to, other than the programs that are currently in place, what steps are you going to take to address this issue?
Well, we're very proud of the CJCs. You probably know that they fall under the Attorney General's office, and for me, that's one of the crown jewels of the office. It's one of the reasons I was excited to run for Attorney General, because I wanted to work with the professionals that we have. It's a multidisciplinary model that brings people of all different backgrounds together to put children who are suffering from the cycle of abuse in a safe environment and help them get the resources that they need to begin to heal. So during my tenure, we've helped support the opening of several more children's justice centers. Proud of that work. We launched together as CJCs and others in the community fighting against domestic violence and child abuse, One with Courage campaign, in which we took stories from many victims and talked about how if they had the resources that we have now in their children's justice centers, they wouldn't have suffered nearly as much as they have. And so it's been a very powerful and very successful campaign. We'll continue to seek funding to expand wherever we can, the public-private partnership model. I think government should stay as lean as possible. I'm not trying to expand government. There's certain things that only government can do or should do. But beyond that, we rely on the private sector to come and help join us in getting these critical resources to victims, especially those kids that we see in the children's justice centers.
Mr. Reyes, if I can invite you to keep this next response to about a minute as we are working the clock.
Okay.
Cameron Carlson, please.
Do you feel the Attorney General should defend laws that he or she may not personally support or does not personally support?
Yes. Is that good? Yeah.
I'll let you expand just for a couple of seconds on that.
Absolutely. It's the sworn oath of the Attorney General. Otherwise, the Attorney General cannot defend laws for political reasons or for personal reasons that have essentially exercised a litigation veto. They've usurped the role of the lawmakers. That's the legislature and the governor. And so I've always said, if you want to make laws or veto laws, you should run for a different office. When you swear to uphold, obey, and defend the laws and the Constitution of this state, that's exactly what it means, regardless of the fact that there are laws that I don't think are good laws. And we try on the front end to work with legislators to pass good laws. But like a defender in the federal court system and a public defender, sometimes you may not like that client, but it's the part you play. And a way to regain trust is by playing your role with integrity. If you can pick and choose which laws you want to defend or not, how are the people ever going to trust that you're doing what's right under the law instead of what's right in your mind?
Thank you very much, Mr. Reyes. We're approaching the conclusion of the hour. The format called for a minute summary statement. We have exactly a minute if you have some final thoughts you'd like to share.
Sure. Well, I would like everybody to think back with me to the year 2013, if you would. The AG's office was mired in scandal in the middle of divisive cases regarding immigration, polygamy, and marriage. The legislature just spent millions on a report that was shocking about my predecessors. And what about the 99% of dedicated professionals in the office? Many of them questioned whether it was worth staying. When I took over, the AG's office was at the lowest point in its storied history. Today, morale has never been higher. There may be some disgruntled employees. Not everyone likes when you raise the standard or you push them to work harder or you have performance evaluations when none existed before. But today, the great public servants in my office can hold their heads high. Finally, they have the resources that they need. They have the technology, the salary, the respect that they deserve. And with this newfound confidence, they can represent Utahns in the way that you deserve. That transformation doesn't happen without leadership, without hard work and integrity. So I hope you'll vote for the proven leader and the true lawyer for the people, Attorney General Sean Reyes. Thank you.
Thank you, Attorney General Sean Reyes, for your participation in the event this evening. Thanks to Hal Boyd of the Deseret News and to our outstanding student panel of questioners. Also, special appreciation to the administration, the faculty, staff, and students of Dixie State University for providing this wonderful venue for this first televised debate of the 2016 election season. The Utah Debate Commission would have me remind you that the next debate will be at 6 p.m. on Monday, this coming Monday, September 26th, from Utah State University in Logan. That debate will feature candidates for Utah governor, two of them, we trust. If you would like to attend that or subsequent debates, or if you have a question that you would like to submit for consideration, please visit the Utah Debate Commission website at utahdebatecommission.org. There you'll find video archives that will contain this and all of the season's debates. Thank you for watching and engaging this evening. We invite you to exercise your right to vote on or before November 8th for the candidates of your choice. In St. George, I'm Bruce Lindsay, wishing you a good evening and thanking our live audience tonight. Thank you.